This is WJCT News 89.9 in Jacksonville. Opinions expressed on the Friday Media Roundtable are those of our panelists and do not necessarily reflect the views of WJCT News.
Welcome back. You're listening to First Coast Connect. It's Friday, so that means it's the Media Roundtable. Let me give you some of the items on today's menu. Jacksonville's uptick in violent crime, the mayor's budget unanimously approved, Florida's federal redistricting trial, JEA's proposed rate hike increase in 2024, and then later, the Sanctuary on 8th Street is stopping by with a look at their upcoming event, The Shindig. It's a full show, so let's dive in. Joining me today for our roundtable discussion is Charles Griggs, regular contributor and owner of 8th and Whitner. Charles, how you doing, man?
Good morning, Al.
David Berline, reporter for the Florida Times Union. David, my friend, how are you, sir?
Good morning, Al. Hi, everybody.
And our local Clark Kent, Dan Scantlin, reporter for Jax Today. Dan, how you doing this morning?
Reporting for duty, sir.
Thank you. Listeners at home, you can join the conversation. Give us a call at 549-2937. You can tweet us at FCC On Air. First Coast Connect to WJCT.org. You can find us on Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube, all the places. We want to hear from you. Join the conversation. Before we dive into local stuff, it just came out that Senator Dianne Feinstein has passed away at 90 years old. She leaves behind a long legacy. She started off as being a part of the parole board, the Women's Prison Board in California in 1960. She was the mayor of San Francisco, and we all know her, I think, mostly because she's been a longstanding senator. So she just passed away today, and we give condolences to her family. But there's been a lot of controversy in the last couple of years with Dianne being, getting older and also seeming to not really understand what was going on around her in the Senate.
Very dynamic, being the old guy in the room, very dynamic person, always saw her as in the forefront, whether it was the state government, the city government, or on the federal front, and to see the decline in age was heartbreaking, because I remember her as always being this just out front person and always with a strong stance on whatever issue was up.
Yeah, I think I agree completely with Dan's saying. I mean, she came into kind of power as the mayor of San Francisco right after this horrific shooting of openly gay mayor of San Francisco. So she really was thrust into the political hot seat from the beginning. She was at the center of so many of the pivotal debates, shaped the debate really a lot, and certainly shaped the Democratic Party in California into the dominant party in that state. It's going to be a tremendous free-for-all to replace her, and there's going to be a lot of it'll be interesting who ends up coming out on top in that race.
Yeah, and it's unfortunate that you have to put a political spin on it, and when someone passes away in office, but she'll be missed as a politician. But the Democrats are now going to have to figure out, how they're going to hold majority in the Senate in order to get the business done. At least keep balance of power going, throughout Congress. Because without her, being in that seat, they were in a position where things could really go, left, so to speak, in a right kind of way. So it'll be interesting to see what happens in the coming days as people kind of let the condolences wane and the politics start to take over.
Yeah, I definitely want to be sensitive to the fact that she passed away. And again, sending condolences to her family and people who loved her and her constituents who loved her as well. But I do think there is a relevant issue to talk about, in the fact that I think a lot of her constituents felt that she wasn't able to represent them as she got older,
right,
especially in the last couple of years. And then a lawsuit came out recently from her daughter challenging basically her care and the finances. And it made it really clear at that point that that she really was not, able to handle these issues on her own. What it brings up for me is that, I'm curious if how the panel feels about age limits as politicians. I mean, there are age limits in a lot of different occupations. Like, for example, with pilots, you can only go to a certain age before you can no longer fly anymore. And I should say that all of us around this table have a lot of gray in their hair. So what do you think, guys?
You know, I remember watching Paul Newman racing at Daytona Speedway, and the car number was his age, which I believe was like 74. And he was fantastic at doing the job. Age was not an issue for him, but at night his stints were short because he couldn't see as well. If you're able to do the job and you can prove it by your performance, I say go for it. But my last image of Dianne Feinstein was in a wheelchair in the Capitol, and I think that's going to stick with a lot of people, that she had declined that far. And the prior stories were she was befuddled. She was not able to answer questions. Maybe it was time. Maybe there should be an age limit. But again, I've known some older folks older than me who are rocking and rolling.
Yeah, I wouldn't be for an age limit. I think that's at some particular point that becomes a slippery slope on what you begin to regulate in terms of how people serve. Term limits may be a better solution to that versus because I like, you know, Dan mentioned there are a lot of older people who are way sharper than I am, you know, and so
no.
And I wouldn't, you know, I wouldn't put it past them to be able to serve full productive terms. So I would hate to see that they are, you know, limited because of an age limit in that kind of way.
It seems to go ahead, David.
I would agree that voters decide whether somebody's able to represent them or not. I would sort of support age limits for Supreme Court justices. I mean, that's an unelected office. And, you know, at some point, they just like to hang on. Mm-hmm. It's a prestigious role. But do we really want the Supreme Court decisions being sort of filtered through a justice who's out of it and just being written by 30-year-old law clerks?
Right.
So I would be more supportive, perhaps, of looking at age limits for justices and the Supreme Court. You know, it's a 6-year term. So, and age is going to be a factor in our next presidential election. A 6-year term for Senate. So, 4-year term for president. We're going to, you know, it's possible we'll have two pretty old candidates for president if Biden faces Trump.
Yeah, that was the next place I was going, is that like it feels like Trump loves to categorize Biden as being too old and out of it and not able to keep up. But I think age-wise, they're pretty close in age, aren't they?
They are.
Just a few years.
Yeah. So it does feel like age will be a factor in that race. But David, you make a great point that with Senator Feinstein, like she was voted in by her constituents, whereas with Supreme Court justices, they are not voted in. So does that line, do you think that line is what makes the difference? Like if people can elect you and they are okay with your age, then so be it. But if you are not being elected, if you're appointed for it, maybe we should think about that.
I think absolutely. And there may even be an age limit for other federal judges. For some reason, the Supreme Court, there isn't. I mean, it'd be good for turnover on the court. It would, it's a lifetime appointment, but that doesn't mean you should be able to do it till your date of death. And people get older. It's just a fact. They start to lose some of their mental abilities and capacities. And you're talking about a panel that sets the law for everybody in this country. You know, and obviously it would have been a different political landscape if Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who I know people have huge fans of her, but if she had left the court and allowed President Obama to appoint somebody in her place, it'd be a different court. So it might take away some of the sort of political, randomness about when these appointments come up and spread it out. So it's not so much chance who happens to be president at the time.
I think we probably also have been, the public over a period of time has been sort of hypnotized by the fact that it is a lifetime appointment. And that person would probably die in office, because people use that term when they're talking about Supreme Court justices. So we probably have to start thinking differently in terms of those lifetime appointments and do consider to be a limit on that. Much like people retire at a certain age, you don't have to, But most people see an age where they'd like to retire. And maybe perhaps there should be a retirement age on a lifetime appointment.
Yeah. I mean, we can't really legislate and deal with the Supreme Court when it comes to conflict of interest. So I think that the idea while this is a good conversation and a good debate, mm-hmm. I think the chances of us looking at that are pretty rare.
Yeah.
You know, having a civil, smart debate about age limits in Congress where they can't even agree to keep the federal government running feels like a pipe dream. Let's transition into local issues. Gun violence has spiked over the last 10 days in Jacksonville. At least 21 people have been injured or killed. In a press conference Wednesday, Sheriff T.K. Waters reached out to the community for help.
When I say outrage, I want people to be angry about it enough that we talk about it and that we sit down together and we come together with solutions. I've said this a bunch of times. We have to have community and police together, working together. Listen, we're members of this community. All we are is we're employed to do this as a career, but we all have a responsibility to the place that we live.
We played that clip because I had some thoughts about it. Number one, I think that like in this community, people have been talking about violence for a very long time. That a lot of people, a lot of activists throughout Jacksonville have been outraged about it. And I think when the sheriff says that he wants to work with the community, I think that a lot of that has to come from a place of the sheriff actually talking to the community and not being in a position where he's dictating to the community. I think that we have to talk in order to make the solutions. So I invite the sheriff to come onto this program and talk to me because I would love to have a conversation with him and let the community members talk to him about where they think violence is. The only way you can move forward with what the sheriff has said he wants to do is to actually talk to people.
Well, he had his town hall meeting and there were dozens and dozens of community organizations out there. iCare even holding up the number of dead at the time. And of those people that we've mentioned, we've had 9 kids as young as 1 year old, as old as 16. 9 so far killed this year. We had a 3 and a 6-year-old killed this week. The sheriff did point out that the latest death, the child was sleeping in a bed with their 12-year-old sibling when one bullet got them both. And he did imply that the one last weekend at a high-end Southside condo complex was gang-related, not per se due to an argument over a dog sale. Within 30 minutes of that news conference, Isaiah Rumlin of the NAACP issued a statement. Mad Dads had already been out there. So community groups were putting their outrage out there as they did during the recent racial shooting near Edward Waters, et cetera, et cetera. And maybe it is time for the sheriff and community leaders and faith leaders to sit down and speak. In December, following the shooting death of that young man in the car on Moncrief or on Myrtle, he did stand in front of the sheriff's office with about 50 community and faith leaders. That gathering and then conversation is probably what's necessary.
I've been in Jacksonville long enough to know that this is not a new issue. This was not something that happened when T.K. Waters became the sheriff. It goes back a very long way. So I would not put these deaths on his doorstep. And that's not what I was saying. What I'm saying, though, is that, like, clearly what we are doing as a community and what is going on with policing, it's not working because this has been a long-term problem. And there has to be new solutions. And I think that in the past, what I've seen is a lot of talk from sheriffs that maybe were more interested in actually hearing and talking with the community, but not a whole lot of action. I think the best action that I saw since I've been here, I've been in Jacksonville since I was 11, and I'm older now. But I would just say that like the Jacksonville journey seemed like it bore fruit.
Yeah, so the law enforcement has its own perspective of how to protect the community or prevent crime from occurring. You know, we can't really fault them for having that perspective because that's, you know, who they are. And you're correct. You know, prevention will not come from law enforcement because the enforcement part is what they're good at, right? So they get there after it's happened. What has to happen, though, to your point, Al, is that people have to sit down and talk and try to figure out, you know, how do we integrate the resources across the board in order to prevent violent crime from occurring in the first place. It's not going to come from the law enforcement part. You know, the sheriff's office is always going to get there while the crime is occurring or after it's occurred. It's always going to be too late. So the sheriff can be angry, but his anger does not do much in order to prevent crime. I was just kind of, when we were watching his press conference, I was wondering what the perpetrators were thinking if they were watching that press conference. You think they were probably perhaps afraid? They weren't, because this is how they do business. And so, you know, you have to appreciate what those organizations are trying to do. Many organizations in the community, including the government, are trying to find ways to prevent violent crime from happening in the first place. And that's not going to happen by the time it gets to the sheriff's.
You know, the sheriff did also push for people to send in tips, and he had Crime Stoppers with them. So that's obviously another push, and somebody knows something is what he was saying.
We've got a comment, I believe, from Facebook. This is from Kathy Frazier, president of Northside Coalition of Jacksonville, said the following: "We are outraged at you, Sheriff. We are outraged at you because the Northside Coalition, the 38 churches affiliated with CARE, and many others have been research-based, proven, successful, community-driven group violence intervention model program from the National Network for Safe Communities. You have refused to do so, saying JSO's version of the program is working just fine." And that's part of her.
That's the adult civil citations that ICARE has wanted. And the sheriff a week and a half ago right here did tell me that he prefers the other version, which is the notice to appear, which then possibly ends up with you and the judge agreeing to dismiss the charge. So there's no criminal record. This sheriff and the previous sheriff have not wanted to meet with ICARE to discuss that.
We're going to go to the phones. We've got Stanley on the north side. Stanley, how are you?
I'm fantastic. And hello, everybody, especially my good long friend, Greg. I'm glad to hear him on the show.
Wait, Stanley, hold on. I'm not your friend? You call me so much, I feel like I should be your friend.
yeah, you are definitely my friend here, but me and you need to have a one-on-one.
All right. Let's go to your question. Yes. Go ahead.
Yes, I have a question here. My research... I try to share information with this community because I share information across the country here, especially from the African-American perspective. And my concern here, when I look at all this information, all this data for the last 400 years, before we can do anything, it's for decreasing crime. We need to get rid of the gun. That's the only thing that we need to address first, is the crime. And when I mean the crime, when it comes to those guns, we have too many guns. It's too easy for people to get a gun. Mm-hmm. And until we address that issue, I'm going to be politically correct. We are just going to be talking. Mm-hmm. And in closing, this is very important here. There is many organizations out here in the community, and I'm in the community all the time. I'm in City Hall all the time. Where when it comes to these organizations, all these organizations are reactive and they are looking for money. Thank you.
Stanley, thank you so much for calling in.
I think Stanley brings up a great point regarding guns. Now we saw where the sheriff has, you know, made an arrest regarding, they were displaying some guns that they found. And they said that those guns were, some of them were stolen, some of them were bought on the streets. And people leave their guns in their cars, they leave them unsafe places in their homes, and there's no accountability for that. There's no accountability if someone steals a gun out of someone's car. The guns haven't been secured. And over time, we've seen where people have been resistant to policies leading to accountability, where someone leaves their gun in a place where it's unsafe and it can be stolen and used in a commission of a crime.
You can join the conversation at 549-2937. Tweet us at FCC On Air. First Coast Connect to WJCT.org. You can find us on Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube. You know all the places. We want to hear from you. Join the conversation.
I was going to say, I think the sheriff's right that the community does have a role to play in terms of the sheriff department. They need people in the community to provide them information in order to solve these crimes. And so to the extent that the community does not trust or people do not trust the sheriff's office to come forward, that's a problem because I think we would all agree that someone who commits a violent crime is likely to commit another one until unless they're arrested. So to the extent that there's this gap between the people who can provide information to help the sheriff office or police solve crimes, that is a real problem. Just following up on Dan said, I would disagree that to the extent that people aren't outraged. I mean, Dan mentioned Mad Dads. Its very name says people have been mad for a while about the violent crime situation. I don't think that's the issue, that there's not enough anger about this. But, you know, if people know something about these two violent shootings that killed a 3-year-old and a 6-year-old and they don't come forward, they need to. Because that is something that the community needs help with.
And speaking about Mad Dads, tomorrow at 11 o'clock, they actually start their annual motorcycle ride around town. And that ride will pass places where victims have died from violent crime. And they're going to be out there on this ride, as they've done for, I think, 20 years plus, to remind you of the violence that's happening. And hopefully you work towards finding solutions. And Mad Dads, last night, Urban League apparently held a meeting with residents to discuss issues. Pastor Gundy is holding a meeting tomorrow for women to discuss violence. So the community is out there and working on stuff. But that's it. The sheriff was asked on this week, AK-47s, expensive weapons, how can they afford it? Well, by the time they're stolen and work their way through the street system, they're fairly inexpensive if you need a weapon.
I would say, just to push back a little bit, David, on what you're saying, I don't disagree with you that the police need help and they need, you know, information. But I think that if there is no trust between the police and the community, why would anyone come forward? Why would, if I don't trust you, why am I going to have a conversation with you? And I think that if the law enforcement comes from a very top-down type of way, if you feel like the police that you see every day are not friendly to you or do not feel like you can trust them, you're not going to get that type of information. So, you know, I think that the two things, both the department and the community, have to take steps towards each other. And that's a difficult process because there's a lot of things in between. There's a lot of distrust from police. I know that police right now feel like in many ways that they are under attack, that, like, you know, when the movement to quote unquote defund the police departments, the police departments were feeling very much like they were being attacked by activists in the community. And I know the community feels like they, like Kelly Frazier was just saying, they feel like they're being ignored. Like they're saying, like, hey, we've got these ideas. Can we work together? And getting the silent treatment, that creates distrust. And so, you know, in order for these things to come together, and it's on the police department because they have the power, right? That you have to find ways to make inroads. And they have to be genuine inroads because people can smell it a mile away when you're just trying to get information. And it feels like, you know, do you really care about me? Or are you just trying to, like, you know, show that you picked up a bunch of guns on TV and pat yourself on the back? And so there's a big difference between that. And that's the gap that Jacksonville has been in for a long time. It's not new. It's not T.K. Waters' fault. Right. It is the paradigm that we're in.
Right. You know, to that point, I've had conversations with people throughout the community who represent different organizations who feel like at this point, everything is on the table. You know, they're willing to talk to anyone and work with anyone if it'll help solve the problem. And then when they get to the point where they're dealing with traditional government silos, they get pushback because of the way that it's always been done. And so that's not working in the spirit of collaboration. And to your, you know, like you said, it's been here before Sheriff Waters, but it may be upon Sheriff Waters to, you know, just change that paradigm and say, okay, you know, we know what our feelings are about law enforcement. We know how strong we feel about how we do things. We're going to leave all that outside, and everybody's going to come in. We're going to put everything on the table, and we're going to figure this thing out together.
Right.
And I just to circle back, I agree completely with you. I mean, I'm saying this is the state of play is this, that the sheriff's office needs community support, community information. How they get that is something that they have a responsibility to work on their behalf too. And I really don't have any kind of sense of how, whether the trust factor is higher or lower than in Jacksonville than in those other urban cities, but my sense is it's probably lower. And that's a problem for law enforcement. It's a problem for public safety. It's a problem for the communities that suffer the worst violence. And I think there needs to be some effort to break through that by doing something different in order to change that paradigm. Because you're right. I mean, we do these stories over and over again. Duval County is the most violent county on a per person basis in the state. It has been the murder capital. The facts are whatever's been happening has not been working well enough, no doubt.
And I'll tell you that a month ago or so at the Dollar General shooting, the mood on the street was they didn't really trust the police. I was out there for over an hour and listening to just conversations that were occurring. They knew exactly what had happened at that store long before the news conference, as I now reconstructed in my head. And it was scary to be there, but it was enlightening to hear a community unfiltered giving opinion and truth.
Yeah. And Al, you mentioned earlier Jacksonville Journey. One of the reasons why Jacksonville Journey was on a path towards success is because the mayor, Mayor Payton at the time, was emotionally moved by the drive-by shooting of Deshaunna Davis.
Yes.
I mean, and that's what triggered. I mean, he was like, we got to do something. And he was like, hey, everybody's going to be involved and everybody's going to work together and everyone's going to help find the solutions. And that's how we got to that program that that was working so well.
On Tuesday, the Jacksonville City Council unanimously approved Mayor Deegan's first budget. It includes $1.7 billion in general fund expenditures and $4.237 million in capital improvement. I don't even know how to say that big number. It's a lot of money. But capital improvement is extremely important. So how does this budget compare to previous year's expenditures?
Well, it's up. So it's about 14% higher for the general fund. So there's going to be a lot of money spent by the city this year on city services that people should be able to notice. You know, the yards, the ditches are going to get mowed more often. There's going to be street resurfacing in your neighborhood, sidewalks, all that kind of thing. And then there is going to be a pretty big capital improvement budget, which is, again, the neighborhood stuff you notice, a new library in your neighborhood or street construction, drainage. It's going to be a very active city budget.
What are the outcomes for the two floor amendments, the charter school and the homelessness programs?
So the homelessness program was defeated. That was one where Council Member Terrence Freeman, wanted to use $3.1 million for homelessness programs, but he wanted to take it out of this $25 million pot of money that the mayor wanted set aside so she could come to council and say, here's my recommendations from my transition committee on how to use it. So there may well be that amount of money for homelessness when she comes forward with her proposal. And then for the charter school, that was a really interesting debate. It was one where the city's going to spend $1.4 million to help the Jacksonville Classical Academy build a gymnasium. And the justification for that for the city's side of things is that the gym is being built on land that used to be a ash dump site. It was cleaned up to federal regulations, but there's still some ash deeper down. And there's also some basement from when it was an ash incinerator site. And so for the school to build this gym, they have to do, it's going to cost more to get around some of those underground obstructions. So I tell you, you just, everywhere you dig down deep in Jacksonville, just about all over this city, and there's just junk from age-old problems where someone just said, you know, let's just bury the problem and see if we can walk away from it. It doesn't work that way.
And that site's been a concern for decades. among neighbors who are concerned about the ash out there. And the only way that I know of to do that is you've got to layer good dirt on top of bed to a depth where you can physically get away from it. Yeah. Wow.
You just gave me a metaphor for America, though, David. Like, let's just bury it and walk away.
What lies beneath,
yeah,
in every sense of the word.
I think this is, this being Mayor Deegan's first budget, probably have to look at it two ways. This is Mayor Deegan's first budget, but this may not be Mayor Deegan's budget. You know, a lot of this had to be done with this, in the spirit of the previous administration's budget, because there's such a short period of time in order to develop a budget. I think what we'll probably see in next budget cycle next year is Mayor Deegan's real budget that sort of looks like what her vision was during the campaign. But given the amount of money that we had, the city has on hand, there is room to do all of the things that that was, you know, kind of etched out in from the previous administration, and then make sure that they, like the $25 million for the transition committee work is in there, so that you can actually start to build a path towards the projects and policies that you campaigned on.
What did the mayor mean when she talked about generational investments?
So I would say some of the capital improvements program, that stuff that people are going to be using for a generation. So that kind of thing. The idea that there's going to be projects done that someone 25 years from now will be using. And I think that's mainly it. I mean, I don't know that the budget is very similar, you're right, structurally to the Lenny Curry budgets or predecessor. But, you know, Deegan supported adding more police on the campaign. There's more police in here. It's still public safety is more than half the spending. So I don't know that that's going to change next year necessarily. We'll wait and see if she really does change it. I mean, the Lenny Curry administration was spending even more money on capital improvements project than Deegan has in this budget. So if she wants to change that, she's got a high bar.
My question is 18-0, obviously somebody wasn't on council, unanimous approval. Do we see that ever again on a Mayor Deegan budget?
Well, Rory Diamond wasn't there. He's been,
of course,
out of the military.
He's deployed, but yeah, that amazed me. And then within literally minutes, Mayor Deegan had a statement about the budget. So obviously she felt comfortable that it was going to get passed without a question.
And another thing is that, when you're the mayor and you're trying to get your budget done, you know, you do a lot of work beforehand. I've seen years when there have been way more amendments than what we saw Tuesday night, and it takes a long time to get those amendments through. People try to, you know, work those amendments and they get what they want for themselves or their constituents or their districts out of those amendments. And you didn't really see that happen this time.
Yeah. We're going to go to the phones. We got Tom on the west side. Tom, how are you today?
I'm wonderful. How about yourself?
Good, sir. What do you got for me?
I just wanted to know if Mayor Deegan was able to get the money she wanted for the removal of the Confederate monument. After all, you know, the previous mayor had said that he was going to get the monuments removed. And now we've gone through the next administration. So let's see if we can get this done. Oh, and one point about the earlier thing. If the police would improve their historically low case closure rate for homicides, we'd probably be a lot safer.
Tom, thanks so much for your question. We'll throw it to the panel.
I think they're at 50% right now in clearance, according to what's on their transparency page for homicide. So I don't know how that ranks with other cities. That doesn't sound too bad to me right now when I look at some of the cases that I've written about where there's almost no evidence.
And then on the Confederate monument, the city council under the Curry, when Curry was mayor, approved putting $500,000 or authorization for either moving the monument or modifying it or contextualizing it. So it said all the options should be on the table for using that $500,000. That money is still there, but those restrictions are still there. And Mayor Deegan made no effort to remove those restrictions so that it would be able to use it for moving it without going back to council to get its permission.
A federal trial questioning the constitutionality of Florida's redistricting maps began this week. Attorneys representing voting groups argue that DeSantis-backed maps are discriminatory. So just to remind our listeners, how are these maps redrawn and how would it impact voters in those areas?
Yeah, it would have a big impact because, you know, it would basically take the Jacksonville and it would instead of it being a district that is Nassau, a lot of Duval and St. and in Clay counties, which is a Republican leaning district, it would turn it into a district where it's a majority of where the votes were basically decided by black voters would have the decisive say in who gets elected. So it has a huge impact on both partisan and also on the racial dynamics of that district.
It looks like the district will be probably redrawn to look similar to the previous map where it stretched out past just a little past Tallahassee. So you had two areas where black voters were the majority and a large percentage and some were Democrats. So you likely get a black representative out of the district at that point.
Right. Previously, it was Al Lawson, right?
Who was
representing that area. Now it's Dan Bean, who's Aaron Bean, who's representing it. And so if the courts side with the voting rights groups, the old map would go away, or DeSantis's map, would go away, and a new one would be put in its place that restores power to the black community in those areas.
Yeah, and it probably would, you would think that in all likelihood, if the legislature were forced to redo the map and adhere to what the courts say, it would in all likelihood go back to the map that they had drawn before DeSantis said, "I don't like that map."
Or the other option would be the legislature had a proposal to take that district and make it all in Duval County,
right,
where it covered a much bigger portion of Duval County than it does now. And that would have been a district that would have had where black voters would have had the decisive say in who gets elected.
But you can't get it all done just by Duval County, because the previous map, remember the old snake map, went all the way down to Orlando. So you had to, it was a way to bring representation into Northeast Florida. The argument was that was, irregular. It didn't pack voters, and so that's how the previous map, the Al Lawson district, came to be, because it was more compact, so to speak. It just ran across the top of the state of Florida past Tallahassee.
I think one of the proposals would have been entirely within Duval County. It wouldn't have covered all of Duval County, but it would have covered a larger portion of Duval County than the current district does, and it would have created that ability for black voters to elect the candidate of their preference.
And of course, during all this, the man who is behind this is campaigning and not really saying much about it, so it's probably time for someone who actually knows how to draw a district to draw a district.
Yeah. Speaking of which, nationally, how do you think... I'm throwing this to the panel. How do you think DeSantis is doing in his quest to become the president of the United States?
I think the governor is campaigning in a way where he's sort of just biding his time and hoping that Donald Trump gets put in jail prior to the election, and he kind of by default becomes the next man up. He's not really doing anything on the campaign trail to earn his number one spot beyond. And in fact, none of them are. To doing anything to beat Donald Trump as the Republican nominee, all of them are pretty much just kind of waiting either become the vice presidential pick, for the running mate, or waiting to be next man up in case something happens to Donald Trump.
And DeSantis is literally the only other Republican candidate who's getting any national airtime. He did actually, I think, a week ago have a sit down with Meet the Press. Which for him was, I'm sure, a score. But he's been talked about good as well as not so good when he's mentioned nationally. And I just don't think, Charlie says, unless Trump is out of the picture, I don't see him as anything but a distant second.
He gets dinged a lot because he's not great at the retail politics of it all. He's not good at smiling and
baby kissing.
Yeah, baby kissing and all of that.
Yeah, there were tweets this week about his grimaces and his facial and his body language at the this week's debate. So if you're focusing on that, then the message is lost.
Yeah. So JEA will hold a public hearing in February to discuss the proposed 2.9% rate increase. The trustees are expected to vote on the issue in March. If approved, a new rate would take effect as soon as April 1st, 2024. Do we know what the reason is for this rate hike?
It's all about Plant Vogtle, the big nuclear plant in Georgia where the JEA had this contract to enter into in 2008. And at that time, it looked like a good deal. If they knew then what they know now, they never would have done it. But the cost has just gone up dramatically. And so people are going to be paying for it for the next 20 years at real high rates to get that electricity from the Plant Vogtle nuclear power plant.
Why did it jump so much with Vogtle? Like, what was the thing that failed there?
Well, what happened was the cost of building it just went up. And it was one of those budget-busting construction costs. And then rather than just pull the plug, so to speak, and say, we're not going to go through with this project, the owners of the plant went through with it. And JEA was sort of just on the inside looking, outside looking in, because they don't actually own any portion of the plant. They're just buying electricity from it. So they ended up just being taken for that ride, and now they got to pay for it.
And I imagine finding another provider is complicated.
Very much so. And these contracts, you can't break them. They're called hell or high water contracts, which means come hell or high water, you're going to pay for your share of the cost of this project. And JEA tried to get out of it, and there was just no way. It's an airtight contract where they've got to pay that amount.
Hell or high water always means hell.
But they did say that down the road, eventually in the future, we might be saving, there may be some savings, the way that the power from there is being delivered. But we'll probably be using more efficient energy resources by then. So.
And right now, JEA has to get rid of some of what they thought were the great ideas, like the jet turbine and the coal power. There's costs in getting rid of that. As you drive Heckscher, you're passing by what was once seen as the big dream, the coal, you know, fired power plant that is not per se being used anymore.
Yeah. Are there any other funding solutions to help mitigate the costs?
No, there really aren't, other than just trying to, I mean, that's one portion of the cost of the electricity bill. And so obviously they can look for other ways that they can find less expensive ways to provide electricity. And like Charles is saying, who knows? I mean, there could be advances in solar power, and that could help to offset the cost of the nuclear power. There could be changes in the technology in the future on how other types of electricity are generated, but there's no way to reduce the cost of what the electricity they're buying from Plant Vogtle, which I think is about 10% of the power is what they're getting from Plant Vogtle. So maybe the other 90%, they can find ways to offset that high cost by getting cheaper electricity elsewhere.
Yeah. Wind turbine.
It's killing the whales.
Is it really?
That was a line. Yeah, I saw that this week. Yeah, I don't know how, but...
And we got time for like one more subject, and that is, like, it looks like we are headed towards a government shutdown by way of a Florida representative, Matt Gaetz, who seems to be leading the charge on the Republican side to thwart his party or the leadership of his party. How do we think that's going to affect us here on the First Coast?
Yeah, it probably depends on what kind of restrictions, how far they go with the shutdown. You know, this is obviously a city that's got a lot of federal investment in it, starting with the Navy on down. So it's kind of weird. Kind of people are like so desensitized to these debates, right, and almost thinking that something's going to stop at the last minute. They're going to get a deal. But I mean, it's going to mean a lot of everyday services are going to be suspended.
Yeah. So most of the people who will be impacted will be working essentially for free, right? Mm-hmm. So in some cases, some, you know, offices or services may be down, but many of the folks who are impacted by this will be working without getting a paycheck for as long as the shutdown occurs. And that's when you get people, you know, in between the crux and the craw, is because they have bills to pay, right? And they're government employees. And when you're on that level, you're in Congress and you're trying to make a political point at the, you know, at the behest of your constituents, you know, at some particular point, people start holding you accountable for that. And we'll just see how long it takes in order for that to occur.
All of our Navy sailors at the three bases here, all of the federal law enforcement that work out of Cecil will be working without a paycheck. But they will, as the Navy told me earlier this week, they'll be provided for. And eventually their families, who will not be getting any money from mom and dad out at sea or in the air, will get helped by the community, we hope.
All right. And it's about that time. Oh, I love it when a plan comes together. Thank you, Brady. All right, guys. So I'm going to start with Mr. Griggs. Please, what you got for me?
Well, today is the next to the last day of Prostate Cancer Awareness Month. And as you heard, City Councilman Terrence Freeman announced that he had prostate cancer. And from what I understand, he's going to be trying to do his part to bring awareness to prostate cancer as we pray for him as he goes through his treatment.
Absolutely.
So St. Johns County had a meeting where they had hundreds of comments about what they should do with the World Golf Village down in that's being vacated because of the Golf Hall of Fame's moving out of the estate. My editor had one suggestion: let's make another Buc-ee's out of it.
And 10:45 tomorrow, kickstands up for the Mad Dads Jacksonville Motorcycle Ride for Life. They're starting at the Adam Inc. Harley-Davidson on Bay Meadows, and they're going to basically ride to every homicide location in the city to raise awareness for violence and remember those victims.
David Berline and Dan Scantlin, thank you so much for coming in to talk to me today.
Thank you.
Thank you, Al.
Thank you all.
And we will be right back after this.
Amelia Island Chamber Music Festival launches its season this November with Royal Wedding cellist Sheku Kenne Mason and the Jazz at Lincoln Center Orchestra with Wynton Marsalis and guest vocalist Ashley Pizzotti. Info at ameliaisland.com/chamber.
Wayne Hogan of the Terrell Hogan Personal Injury and Wrongful Death Law Firm. When people are hurt through no fault of their own, answering who, what, when, where, why, and how is critical to proving the truth. More at terrellhogan.com.
Tick. I'm not here to hold the government hostage. I'm here to hold Kevin McCarthy to his word.
Talk.
Some of my colleagues have frankly been stuck on stupid.
On the roundup, parts of the federal government prepare to shut down. Presidential history is made on a picket line. And Vermont sees red over visiting leaf peepers. That's next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. You are listening to First Coast Connect. I'm Al Ledson, sitting in the big chair in Studio 2 live at WJCT. And my next guest, it's a pleasure to have him and his organization. I honestly do not think that I would be sitting in this chair if it was not for the Sanctuary on 8th Street. I was working at the Sanctuary on 8th Street many, many years ago when I was much younger, and working there changed my life. It was a life-changing experience getting to hang out with those kids who are still, you know, good friends of mine, and the people who ran it back then, Vicky Watkins, is still like she's like my second mom. And so I am sitting next to the man who took her place, Rick Cartledge. He's amazing, the executive director of the Sanctuary on 8th Street. Rick, how you doing, man?
Doing well, Al. Thanks for having me today.
Of course, of course, of course. Please, for all of our listeners out there that aren't familiar with the Sanctuary, please tell them what you do.
Sure. Well, last year, the Sanctuary on 8th Street celebrated 30 years as an agency, helping children in Springfield with after-school and summer camp programming. And we help children from kindergarten all the way to up 8th grade with a variety of different programs and different partners here in the community. And our biggest thing is to have a place of peace and provide love to children each day.
Yeah. So when I came to the Sanctuary, Vicky basically drafted me. I didn't want to work at the sanctuary, but Vicky wouldn't let me go. She drafted me, and it just changed my worldview. It made me more compassionate and understanding of communities that like I wasn't a part of or didn't understand. And it literally changed my life. I think about it all the time. And so you guys have coming up your annual shindig, which is, you know, partly a show, a celebration of the sanctuary, but also it's there to raise money for the organization. Talk to me about it.
Yes. So the shindig is next Thursday night, October 5th. At Brick and Beam on 1st and Main Street. This is our annual event. This year we're excited because we're going to have the children back performing. We partner with Leanna Howard of Shake Culture Dance, and the children are going to be there performing a dance. We also have some great sponsors such as Ernst & Young, of course, Dolores Barr Weaver and her Forever Event Fund. We're so grateful for her. And it's just a great night to get all of our friends of the organization out to celebrate the children. And we'll also have some silent auction items as well.
Yeah. Earlier today, we talked a lot about violence going on in Jacksonville and some solutions for it. And for me, like a major solution for it is the exact work that you do at the sanctuary on 8th Street. I mean, I would say that like the primary thing that I feel about the sanctuary is that what you do is you provide love. You provide love and encouragement for these young people to like go out and move forward in their life.
I couldn't agree more. You know, it's about listening. It's about listening to the young people, listening to the families, listening to what they want at the center, and then us as a staff providing that each and afternoon and each summer.
Yeah, I think that, you know, when we talk about, you know, people or communities that are quote unquote at risk or dealing with poverty, I think if you've never dealt with it, if you've never lived with it, you have this idea that gets formed in your mind by everything that we consume, from the news to like what we watch on TV to when we're passing somebody on the street and we make value judgments and you don't really know. Like, I thought I understood poverty until I went to work at the sanctuary on 8th Street and realized that like I didn't know anything, you know?
I couldn't agree more. It's taken me many years to catch up with that. Again, it's all about listening. It's about providing a safe place for the young people. And it's about bringing the young people back, you know, to have leadership roles within the organization.
Yeah, exactly. Like a lot of the guys that like I mentored who are now like, oh my God, it's so weird to say this, but like I mentored them when I was in my 20s and now they are in their 30s. Oh, that makes me old. but it's amazing to see like how they come back to the sanctuary and they do things with the kids and so forth. It's like, you know, it keeps giving. It just grows. And so when people support the sanctuary, they're not just supporting what's happening this year. They're supporting like a lifetime of work.
I couldn't agree more. It's about long lasting positive relationships. And so even if the youth is, you know, aged out, we still want to connect with them and find ways to help.
Yeah. So give us the details once again about the shindig.
Yes, we're going to be there, Brick and Beam, next Thursday night, October 5th. It's actually my mom's birthday. Happy birthday, Mom.
Happy birthday, Mom.
And, you know, it's going to be a great event, celebrating the children. It's going to be local food from the Farmery, Strings, Crispies, Kenny's Chicken, Waffle and Mike's. It's going to be a great silent auction, and we're just grateful for all the community support.
Is there a place where someone can get tickets?
Yes. Please go to our website, sanctuaryon8th.org, and check us out on social media.
All right. Rick Cartledge, Executive Director of the Sanctuary on 8th Street, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you, Al.
And that is our show today. You've been listening to First Coast Connect on WJZT 89.9 News. And our executive producer is music maestro David Luckin. Our producer is Stacy the Brain Bennett. Kathy Waterman is our associate producer. Our director, our Martin Scorsese of the operation, Brandy Corum Cornhusker. Cornhusker, man, I love it. Brady Corum. Brady Corum. We'll be back Monday. I'm not going to be here next week, but we have a whole roster of guest hosts that we're going to do a great job. So Jacksonville, remember, keep your heart open for it, Duval and each other, and I will see you when I get back.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.